Okay, so this is the parsha of enumeration. Everything gets repeated here. We go over the amounts of materials, and we also speak about the names of the people who were involved, and many, many details of what happened in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu as they were about to fashion and then actually did make the Mishkan, the mobile home for Hashem. So there are many, many questions that come to mind as to why all of the enumeration, why all the repetition seems all extremely superfluous. If there's one word that can sum up the challenges of Parshas Pekudei, it's the superfluous nature of this Parsha on so many levels. So let's take it from its seemingly redundant beginning. Eile Pekudei HaMishkan, these are the countings of the Mishkan. Mishkan HaEdos, we're in the beginning of the Parsha now. This is the Mishkan, the Tabernacle of Testimony, Asher Pukad Al Pi Moshe, which this was counted or accounted for by virtue of Moshe, Avodas Halevim, the service of the Levites, who would represent the entire nation, B'yad Yisamar ben Aharon HaKohen, they were given over under the charge of Yisamar, who was, of course, the son of Aaron, the high priest. Now, the first obvious redundancy is the fact that it says Eile Pekudei HaMishkan, these are the countings of the Mishkan, and then a moment later it says Mishkan HaEdos, the Mishkan of Testimony. That's superfluity. Is that a word?
Sure, it is now.
Superfluity all over again. Right? That seems entirely redundant. So the question is, why do we have the seemingly redundant expression of Mishkan and then HaMishkan? So Rashi says, "Parsha zu nimnu." In this parsha, we have enumerated kol mishkalei nidvas HaMishkan, all of the weight or the volume of that which was given in the time of the Mishkan. So all of this is now re-enumerated. Lekesef ulezov v'lanacheshef. For the silver, for the gold, and for the copper. V'nimnu kol kelov. We're also going to speak of all the different artifacts. L'chol avedasei, for and the specific things that they're going to be used for. And so Rashi begins, opens his commentary now with, it says Mish HaMishkan, and then it says Mishkan a second time. Could it not have said Eile Pekudei Mishkan HaEdos? Why do we have to have Pekudei HaMishkan, and then a second time the word Mishkan? So Rashi says, Shnei Pa'amim, the word Mishkan is mentioned twice, seems superfluous. Remez l'migdash shenismashkin b'shnei churbanin. This alludes to the Mishkan, which was taken as collateral. Mishkan as collateral for the Beis HaMikdash that was destroyed not once, but twice. So the term Mishkan signifies the notion of something which is temporary in nature, as the word Mishkan comes from the word Shechina. It's not a bait, a bayit, it's not a home, it's not permanent. It's something which houses the Shechina in a temporary basis. So we have this idea of HaMishkan, and then a second time HaMishkan, and the words Mishkan, HaMishkan. This talks to us about the nature, the collateral nature of the Beis HaMikdash, that although the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu took that as collateral, and when there's collateral, that means everything in the end will turn out just fine. So that's why the word Mishkan is mentioned twice. And what kind of Mishkan is it? Rashi explains further. It's a Mishkan HaEdos. What does it mean, a Mishkan of testimony? This is an Eidos LiYisrael. This serves as a testimony for Israel. Sheviter Lohem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God had forgiven them, Al Maisei HaEgel, for the fashioning of an idol. And what's the proof? How do you know God forgave them for fashioning an idol? Because it's Mishkan, it's Shechina, because his presence is amongst them. And if his presence is amongst them, clearly he must have forgiven them. For when they sinned, he took his presence from them. And now if his presence is being returned to them, then it's a sign that he must have forgiven them. So we have this idea of the Mishkan which represents something larger than the small, the mini epoch of the desert. It has a much, much bigger shadow. It casts a shadow over, really, the entirety of Jewish history, which represents the different churban and the different destructions of the Beis HaMikdash, but also the collateral for the ultimate redemption and the rebuilding of the third and eternal Beis HaMikdash, and all that's included in the words of Mishkan. And this Mishkan is a Mishkan of Eidos, it's a Mishkan of testimony that HaRev Shechina resides amongst the Jewish people. All right, so now I know why it says, why there's a notion of Mishkan HaMishkan, and I know why the Mishkan is called HaEidos. Now, I'm gonna skip into the next pasuk. There's what to be said about Al Pi Moshe and Avedas Halevim and Biyada Samer and Aron HaKohen. But let's skip into the next pasuk. The next pasuk tells us that although we already introduced this parsha as one of enumeration, and Rashi says, what will we enumerating here? We'll be enumerating the weight, the volume of that which is dedicated. So we're going to talk about the silver, he said, the gold and the copper, and we're going to find that about all the things that were given. So he says, Ubitzalel ben Uri ben Chur l'mata Yehuda. Bitzalel, the son of Uri, the son of Chur, from the tribe of Yehuda, also Eiskol Asher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. He did everything that God had commanded through Moses. And in verse 23 it says, Ve'ita, and with him, Ahaliyav ben Achisamach. There was a man named Ahaliyav, the son of Achisamach. He hailed from a different tribe, Mate Don, which was one of the less impressive tribes. And he was Chodosh, Ve'cheshe, Ve'rekim, Ve'tcheles, Ve'agom, Ve'tlashoni, Ve'sheish. These are artisans, expert craftspeople working with the different materials that were given. So the obvious question is, why is it necessary for us to re-enumerate the names of the foremen, the people who are responsible for the project? I understand you have to take the gold and the silver and you have to count the volume. I understand that it seems redundant, but in fact we're talking about the Mishkan, not the theoretical Mishkan, but the actual Mishkan. The Mishkan which is Shinis Mashkin that gets served as collateral. The Mishkan that in the end will become Eidos testimony for the Jewish people that Hashem's presence is amongst them. But the question becomes then, why is it necessary to repeat the names of the people who are responsible for the work? I only have to open the Chumash, go back a few pages, and I have to read Parshas Vayakel, and I know who these people are. And then I have to go back to the earlier Parshias, and I see already who they are. So you want to enumerate how much gold, how much silver? We didn't talk about that yet. You want to talk about how this was given over to Moshe Rabbeinu? Okay, I get that, fine. It's going to be given to Moshe. We're going to talk about the actual vessels that were fashioned and made. Okay, why repeat the names for it? Just say, the Jewish people did all these things. I know who led the Jewish people in making these artifacts. We know who was the four people here. So Rashi says, Ubitzalel ben Uri asa eskola asher tziva Hashem es Moshe. Bitzalel did everything that God had commanded Moshe. So Rashi says, very interestingly, it says, asher tziva eisei Moshe ein ksiv kan. It doesn't say he did all the things that Moses commanded him to do. Ella, rather, it says, Kol Asher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, all the things that God commanded Moses to do. But how could Bezalel do the things God commanded Moses to do? Surely God would first have to tell Moses. Moses would have to tell Bezalel. Bezalel would follow the instructions he got from Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Pasuk should have said, Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Chur, of the tribe of Yehuda, did as Kol Asher Tziva Oisai Moshe, exactly as Moshe Rabbeinu had instructed him to do. But instead, it doesn't say that. Instead, it says he did as Kol Asher Tziva Hashem as Moshe. He did all the things that God told Moshe to do. God didn't speak to Bezalel. God spoke to Moshe. So what's going on over here? So Rashi says, Elo. So rather, Kol Asher Tziva Hashem as Moshe. The fact that it says not what Moses told him to do, but what God told Moses. Afilu dvarim shalei amarle. So clearly, even things that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't tell Bezalel, and Bezalel understood by virtue of his own intuition, by reading between the lines of what Moshe Rabbeinu said, he understood what God told Moshe, even when Moshe didn't tell him those things. And those are the things he did. So even things, Shalei Amar Le Rabbi Ba'aseisam, Hiskima B'daitei L'masha Ne'mar L'Moshe B'Sinai. Moshe, somehow Bezalel intuitively knew or did as God told Moses, rather than as Moses instructed him. This is like a Pandora's box. It's dangerous. Like, you're going to have people start doing whatever they want now. So I know what God really told Moses. We have to do exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu said. And yet, Bezalel seems to have done things not what Moshe Rabbeinu said, but rather what God told Moshe. How
does he? That Hashem said specifically that I gave him Ruach Elohim.
This is
so
true.
That's not like any other person, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. God did say he's going to give Bezalel intuition and a higher state of consciousness. So let's take a look and see how Rashi explains this now. So he says, Ki Moshe tzivalu Bezalel, Moshe told Bezalel, l'ases t'chila kelim. He instructed him about the artifacts. He talked about an ark. He talked about a menorah. He talked about a golden table and a small altar. And then he talked about a large altar. He talked about all these things. Here's the artifacts. Here's the things which will fill the Mishkan. V'achakach Mishkan. Then after he talked to him about a Mishkan. Omer le Bezalel. Bezalel said to Moshe, he says, Rebbe, explain this to me. Minig ha'olam la'aseh t'chilo bayis. I think usually people will build a house. V'achakach mesim kelim b'seichai. You don't first go and purchase all the furniture and then say, you think we should buy a house to put this furniture in? Now that we have the couches and the tables and the chairs and the break front, let's have a house to put it into. No, first you buy the house. Then the house is unfurnished. Then you go and purchase furnishings. Omar loy. So Moshe said to him, wow, he says, incredible. Kach shamaiti mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Indeed, this is what I heard from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God did tell me about the structure first and about the kelim only afterwards. Omar loy Moshe. Moshe said, funny, your name is Bezalel. Bezalel, Kael, Hayisa. You were in the shadow of God. Because Bezalel means Bezalel in the shadow. So you were in the shadow of God, so to speak. It seems to be you were eavesdropping. You somehow heard what nobody else heard. In other words, your intuition was right on the money. What you thought was exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me. Ki bevadai, for certainly, kach tziv li HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is what God told me. V'chein asa. And this is then what he did. Hamishkan tchila. He made the Mishkan first. V'achakach asa kelim. And only afterwards did he make the kelim. So, insofar as the question is concerned, if you have a question, say, so, okay, so can anybody do whatever they want? Can anybody just decide by themselves that they're going to do this, that, or the other thing? You know, just, Meisha, didn't God tell you this? So what's important to know here is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Meisha certain things. But Moshe Rabbeinu, in fact, had to be asked by Bezalel. Bezalel said, Moshe, Rabbi, is this what God said? He didn't just make his own decisions. In fact, he listened to Moshe Rabbeinu. He had questions, and only after he had those questions, and Moshe Rabbeinu responded affirmatively, did Bezalel go ahead and make decisions and do that which he had set out to do. So this gives us a little bit of an understanding of how Bezalel didn't just do as he pleased, and ultimately did do as God told Moshe, rather than the things that Moshe Rabbeinu himself told him. But the bigger question is still not answered, why we have to mention Bezalel here altogether. And Uri, I mean, why mention Aliyah, pardon me, Ben Achisamach? Who needed to know about this? If you wanted to say, Eilip Kudeh Mishkan, verse 21 should have been followed by verse 24. It should have said, Kol HaZahav, HaOser, LeMelacha, all of this, the gold that was used for the work, and you hear, here was the Zahava Tnufa, here's how much was taken, and so on and so forth. That's, it would seem, what's necessary, what's required.
Before it said who he appointed, it didn't say, like, this is who Hashem is appointing. Here it's confirming that they did it, though. You know, like.
Well, Moshe Rabbeinu, in truth, already did appoint Bezalel and Uri, and not only did he, Bezalel and Aliyev, not only did he already appoint them, but we already hear in last week's parsha, the methodology through which a person has to be appointed to a public position. Well, he wasn't appointed, so to speak, only by virtue of Moshe Rabbeinu's words, top heavy, but instead. But instead, he had to first get the buy-in of the people. We talked about this already in last week's parsha. In fact, the Gemara tells us, here's how leadership positions have to be acclaimed. Not in spite of what the people want or what the people think, but getting their buy-in. So we talked about all that, and which makes these renders these verses seemingly entirely superfluous. So the Rebbe asked this question. And I just think it's really interesting that of all the redundancy in Parshas Pekudei, this is the one redundancy nobody addresses. Right? We talk about why all the gold, why all the silver, why all the copper, why the artifacts all over again. Okay, but the other question, of course, becomes here, why do we have this emphasis on Bezalel and about on Aliyah. So on page Shin Tzadigimel, which is the fifth number hey of the entries into Parshas Pekudei, the Rebbe asks exactly this question. The question is, why mention the names all over again? These names are already well known to us. They're mentioned several times in Parshas Kisisa. They're mentioned in Parshas Vayakel several times. Another question is, Gam im yesh neitzedech kol shehu loshu v'lahaskir es shmeiseim shel Betzal v'Aliyah. Even if there might be some good reason, for whatever reason, why you have to mention Betzal and Aliyah. And we have a good reason. Rashi told us about Bezalel, that his name was meaningful, Betzel Kel, in the shadow of God. We have like a reason. So even if there's some kind of reason, Ma tzayrich lahafsik l'shem kach be'emtza ha'inyan, why interrupt the cadence, the flow? Parshas Pekudei starts off, and we read in Rashi, what's Pekudei? This is Parsha Zu Nimnu, and this Parsha we're going to be enumerating, Kol Mishkali Nidvas HaMishka, all of the weight and volume of what was donated. Okay? So what's, after making a pasuk like Elo Pekudei HaMishkan, these are the enumerations, what's the next pasuk that should follow? The actual enumeration. From verse 21, we should go straight to verse 24. Kol Azov HaAsoy LeMalacha, all the gold that was used for the work. But instead, for some reason, we interrupt with two verses. One verse about Bezalel, another verse about Aliyah, when the flow is interrupted. For what reason? So that's the two questions. And the Rebbe suggests that there is a foundational and critical reason that the names of Bezalel and Aliyah must show up right here. Something that we don't know about in the previous Parshiot, and something that didn't happen in the previous Torah portions. It only happens in Parshas Pekudei. And this is how the answer goes. As we just read, the Mishkan was not just called a Mishkan, it was called Mishkan Ha'edut. Why is it called Mishkan of Edut? Edut means testimony. Why is it called Mishkan of testimony? Because it served as a testimony that God had forgiven the Jewish people from the sin of the golden calf. And how do we know that? Rashi says, Sharei Hishra Shechina Imam. He placed his Shechina amongst them. You're not wrong, by the way. The luchot are that sign of God's. That's where God's presence is. And this is the famous dispute between Ramban and Ramban. So Ramban, Maimonides, says the purpose of a Beis HaMikdash is to create a circumstance, a situation, a mechanism, a place in which the offerings could be brought. We have mitzvot of God's Torah to bring offerings. We're going to bring the offerings. Without a Mikdash, can't do it. So it's a makom muchon lahakrav bekarbonos, a place that's prepared for you to be able to bring offerings. Nachmanides, Ramban, says no. That's not the primary purpose of a Mishkan. The primary purpose of a Beis HaMikdash is to be Mishkan. Mishkan comes to the terminology Shechina. The God's presence should be there. And that's a subject in and of itself. Why? How Rambam looks at it his way, Ramban looks at it the other way. But I don't want, like, we're not getting into that. I'm just pointing out that the idea of Mishkan, here the Torah specifically identifies the Mishkan as being what kind of Mishkan? Eidos Mishkan. In other words, if you want to define the essence of the Mishkan, which is a permutation of the word Shechina, it's like Shechina is a noun, God's presence. Mishkan is also a noun of sorts. It's a place where God's presence is. So that's a definition, an intrinsic definition of what this is, what this project is about. Okay, so if that's the case, and that's how we get introduced to this entire parsha of Ela Pekudei HaMishkan. And you said, hey, why did you interrupt Pekudei HaMishkan with Bezalel and Aliyah? Pekudei HaMishkan, go straight into Pekudei HaMishkan. So the Rebbe says, 1 second. What kind of Mishkan is it? What's the purpose? What's the point? Testimony, meaning that Hashem's presence is there, that He forgave them. Okay. So the Rebbe says, if so, Lachein hoya Mishkan tzarech li eschayach lachlutin leklal Yisrael, then the Mishkan had to belong to the entire nation. Because it's a sign that God forgave the nation, not an individual, the nation. Now, if that was the case, we cannot have a lingering memory of who owns or who provided what. A person will come to the Mishkan and feel all proud of himself. That's my gold. The woman will show up. That's my mirror. I see it. It's in the kier. Ah, my tapestries. Ah, my wood. I see my wood. I could see it. So then it doesn't work, because this is not a personal thing. This has to become a national and communal and national endeavor. Zui Asiba, this is the reason, the Rebbe says, on a level of jurisprudence, the halachic philosophy of why it had to be brought to the Moshe Rabbeinu. Why did you have to bring it to Moshe? Because Moshe, what was his position? He was the principal of Klal Yisrael, right? He was the Rebbe, it makes him the principal of the nation. So therefore, if you gave it to Moshe, who ultimately were you giving it to? The nation. If Moshe didn't own it for himself, Moshe's ownership is ownership of the community, right? Like the famous idea of Dida Natzach, the Sfarim belong to a Rebbe, doesn't belong to a Rebbe as a personal thing, it belongs
communal.
To the communal, it belongs to the Adasa Hasidim. He's the Nasi of the people, so therefore his ownership, if you will, is not a personal ownership. And this was in order to levater, in order for the people to set aside, or almost like to relinquish, their own personal ownership. So it went from their hands into the hands of Moshe, and now who owned it? Because Moshe was a principal representing the nation. Who owned it ultimately? Well, Moshe, the nation owned it. Now it gets a little dicey. The misnadvim, the people who gave the donations, the commitments, vitru al ba'alusam, they relinquished their own ownership. By giving it to Moshe.
It's already redundant. When you give something, you just give up already on your ownership anyway.
You know, you say that, but it's not so simple, because I can tell you lots of stories of people who made donations and then came and told me what to do with those donations after they gave the donations.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Yeah, but how many of those? How many
what do you mean? They got a tax receipt for it. They got a tax receipt that doesn't belong to you. They still come in and they still feel a sense of ownership. Trust me, he's an accountant, he knows. He deals with tax issues. So yeah, they gave it away, but Moshe Rabbeinu had to give it afterwards to who? He had to give it to the people who were making these things. They had to have some kind of ownership. They had to make executive decisions. Couldn't bother Moshe with every screw, with every nut, with every bolt, they took responsibility for it. Became their baby. So there was a certain amount of ownership, if you will, that went over into their hands. And the same way somebody who gave the gold could say, ah, my gold, my mirror, my wood, my tapestry. Then Bezalel could walk to the Mishkan and saying, ah, my Aron, that's my ark. And the next guy worked really hard in the kier, said, that's my kier, that's my wash basin. Ah, that's my wood. My buddy and I, we made that tapestry. The two women walk by and say, oh, those weavings, that was ours. They had to own it to some degree. However, ultimately, they too then had to pass it off back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And in doing so, it's given over to the community. And that's why the Rebbe says, the names of Bezalel and Aholiab are mentioned. Why? To explain to us that ultimately, everything had to be reenumerated by Moshe Rabbeinu. Because this reenumeration is also an act of acquisition on behalf of the nation. So you ask the question, Caliph, what's going on here? Why the reenumeration? On the simplest of levels, the reenumeration is the actual repossessing of the Mishkan on behalf of the entire nation, so that in turn it could be Mishkan HaEdos. Because Mishkan HaEdos cannot be a personal thing, a personal endeavor. Mishkan HaEdos has to be a global, national, so to speak, a universal, for all of the Jewish people, kind of ownership. And that gives us a little inkling of insight into what seems to be redundant, but is actually extremely novel and dynamic.
That's a satisfying answer.
To be continued.